Hello and welcome to the Healthcare Executive Insights Podcast. My name is Elliot Sloan from the McCallum Group. Today we have a very special guest, Mr. Michael Hunter, who is the president at Team Wellness Center. Michael, thank you for taking time to chat with us today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Please tell me a little bit about your professional background, and then let's talk a little bit more about Team Wellness Center.
Today, I am president of Team Wellness Center. I've been with Team for approximately a little over 17 years. And my career has included executive roles in financial companies, as well as in the medical side of the laboratory business. So eventually making my way through those two industries, I landed at Team Wellness Center, like I said, about 17 years ago, and have been on a trajectory of climbing that ladder at Team and learning this industry along the way, and really truly embracing this vulnerable population that we serve that are suffering from chronic mental illness and substance abuse disorders.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about the scope of work that you do and the patients that you serve at Team Wellness Center.
So Team Wellness Center is probably one of the largest community health providers in the state of Michigan. And as such, we began as a service agency that specialized in mental health services. So we were Team Mental Health Services. But we recognized early on that the need was well beyond just the mental health of the person, that the person needed all of their comorbidities addressed. And so today, and this has probably gone on since 2006 or seven, we're providing total wraparound care for this vulnerable population, who are primarily indigent, homeless, some struggling veterans, adults and children. And we provide mental health, behavioral health, substance use disorder treatment, full dental clinic, full primary care clinic, podiatry, optometry, as well as employment assistance, housing assistance, food assistance, family reunification, whatever we can do, wherever the need is, including transportation. Wow. We just have to step up and meet that need.
Wow. So you're really doing everything you can to get these folks healthy and back into a normal functioning routine in society.
Yes. Yes.
And talk to me about, you know, as a society, why do you think we overlook the importance of behavioral and mental health? It seems like there's a stigma to even talk about it. If you're suffering from it, you don't want to share that with others. And it's been going on for many, many years where it's kind of been brushed under the rug. But here we are today, and people are starting to finally recognize how serious of a global issue it is. I think the pandemic brought it to light. Why do you think it's been something that hasn't really had much attention for so long?
I think because historically, the societies that we've labeled as civilized, historically, those civilized societies have not thrived based on their differences, but they've thrived based on the things that they had similarly to the other people in those in cultures and environments. So when someone was different, then they were labeled as abnormal. They were labeled as deviant, you know. And eventually, those that had that label were not welcomed in mainstream circles, and people wanted to get rid of them. But how do you get rid of these people when they're actually related to, you know, most of the people in the community? And so you're not being honest about it, but you're saying, I'm still a person that loves them, but I don't want to be around them. I don't like the feelings that I have of my own inadequacies because this person is around. So we tucked them away in asylums. And those asylums were typically way out of the way, tucked in a place that was far away from mainstream society and pretty much forgotten by the people in mainstream. So when I believe it was President John F. Kennedy, who in America signed the Mental Health Act, we began to pay attention. And we didn't begin to accept, we just began to pay attention.
Sure.
And we began to put a lot of resources into those asylums and making them more fortitude and doing the job of still keeping people away, but getting more financial support from the government that they exist. And then we eventually said, hey, the treatment in those places have become very inhumane and they're not being effective. People's quality of lives are diminishing and we're mistreating them, we're abusing them. And the horror stories began. And so we need to close them and take a different approach. And the best approach is to reunificate them to the community. And so community mental health care was born when we began to close the asylums.
Sure. And talk to me a little bit more about what you think can be done as a society to slow down the suffering. I mean, we're seeing numbers increasing dramatically over the years. How do we turn this around?
The main thing that we can do is talk about it. So as long as we're talking about it and we're not whispering about it and we're not acting as if it's taboo, we stand the greatest chance to help end the suffering. And I'm glad you framed it like that because it's the suffering that has to end. We don't necessarily have the capacity to cure, if you will, mental illness, but we can intervene so that the suffering isn't a part of the equation anymore. And what we do is we begin to treat it. For example, if we had a physical health ailment, if you were to fall and break your arm, you would not suddenly become taboo to us. We wouldn't whisper that your arm was broken. We would make sure you got a cast. Hey, we would even be excited to sign your cast, right?
Sure.
So we have to get that way about mental illness. When a person is expressing their vulnerabilities to us and saying, I'm feeling depressed. Hey, I don't know how to shake this feeling of anxiety, or I'm hearing voices, that we should not, you know, panic and back up, but we should encourage them and say, well, are you in treatment? Do you know how to get treatment? Have you tried this? Have you talked to this therapist? And make it as part of our normal conversation. And we all will recognize that it is normal to have that particular healthcare problem.
Sure. Now, do you think it's true to say as a society, we also are not trained from an early age the importance of mental exercises, you know, constantly positive affirmations, breathing techniques? You know, a lot of people swear by meditation and, you know, just spending time every day, whether it's 10 minutes or 30 minutes, focusing on mental exercises and positivity. Do you think that that's something that we lack in our society that has a merit to actually having strong mental health?
I agree wholeheartedly because, as I said, historically, when people were different, that's when they began to be shunned, when they were labeled as abnormal. And when we don't share the same interpretation of the world around us, we begin to compete instead of embrace. And that competition feeds the negative side of mental health. And what happens is a person begins to measure themselves a lot of times by the stigmas of society. Society says that I should be happy right now. Well, I'm not happy, but should I express that? So when we are mindful of the positives, if we were encouraging each other in that realm, we would be okay when we discovered that somebody wasn't as positive or as happy as they were yesterday. But instead, if you look at mainstream communication, the media, movies, TV, the news, whatever, what do we highlight? We highlight the negative sides of our society. That's what makes the news. That's what we sensationalize. Oh, can you believe that this terrible horrible thing occurred, and is struggling to find something that's positive that's going on, and something that is uplifting and encouraging. And so we as a society are doing that to ourselves, and whether it's consciously or not, the end result is that more and more people are suffering that could otherwise not.
Yeah. I'm a believer that you need to impregnate your brain every day with positivity, every single day. Look in the mirror, tell yourself how wonderful you are. And eventually your subconscious mind goes to work and really make sure that you are waking up in a good mood with happiness and joy. And it's discipline and kind of training yourself to always work on that positivity internally with that voice inside your head.
Yeah, because some of the psychiatrists, and I'm not a psychiatrist, but some of the psychiatrists that we work with have reminded me that perception is stronger than reality.
Sure.
So the thing that we got to pay attention to is that perception. And what you're describing is building the proper perception about oneself. Mm-hmm. So if the person spends the time with those affirmations, if they're being encouraged and positivity is what they're planting in their life, then that's likely what they're going to grow, because that's going to be the perception they have of themselves and the world around them. And if we can do that, and if more of us can do that, we would have a very pleasant place to live.
Sure. Why do you think it's so challenging for people who are suffering with mental health to get the access to the care that they need? It's not a very easy landscape to navigate, but I know your organization, Team Wellness Center, is trying to get out into the community to break the red tape and to create easy access points, but it hasn't always been like that.
Yeah, so the biggest hurdle that we find of late for access to mental health, there's two sides to it. There's community health, and then there's mainstream health. The mainstream health are people who are typically employed, people who are part of a traditional commercial insurance, HMO or PPO, and they're getting their health care taken care of in the mainstream sense. But the people that are suffering the most are the people who are indigent, people who are homeless, people who are chronically ill. They burn the bridges in their natural support, so family and friends aren't there anymore. They're living on the streets. They're wandering from here to there. And they don't know where to go. And when they think of where to go, a lot of times it's too far from wherever they are. They don't know that they can have transportation support. And another big factor is they don't know what it's going to cost them. And they think, hey, I don't have any money. I can't afford a therapist, you know, and not recognizing that our society has been very, very generous and providing those services and making them available to that population. And so getting the word out to them is so key. And that's why we spend a lot of our time in the field and with our mobile units, so that we make sure that we're doing everything we can to let people know that we exist as a, not only as a provider, a Team Wellness Center, but even as a network. And Team is a contracted provider with the Detroit Wayne Integrated Health Network.
So do you think there is a strong correlation between mental health issues and substance abuse?
Yes. So what we've learned over the years is that a lot of people, I'm trying not to use the word most, but a lot of people who are suffering from a substance use disorder are doing so, or began to do so, trying to self-medicate them their way through their mental health issue.
Sure.
So trying to get rid of that depression, that anxiety, that fear, that reserve, those voices, the hallucinations and things of that nature, they've gravitated to the drugs of their choice and end up getting, you know, addicted to the drug while they were trying to deal with the mental health piece that they were not willing to talk about. And interestingly enough, our society gravitated to addressing more openly and talking about more openly the drug addiction side and alcoholism before we started talking openly about mental health.
Yeah, and what you're proposing, which I've heard before, is the drugs and the alcohol are not the problem. They're actually the solution, the wrong solution, but it's what the person is using as the solution to the problem. So if you can boil it down to the real problem, then it's much easier to get the drugs and alcohol out of the picture.
Yeah. So we spend a lot of time, our therapists do, with their interventions, is trying to get a person to understand and recognize that what they have is an illness. And the root of it is over here on this side. It's in this arena. And if we put the right interventions in place in this arena, you will no longer have to seek the inappropriate outlets. And that inappropriate outlets does sometimes include drugs. And we also see it in inappropriate outbursts of behavior and violence. And unfortunately, too often, we've also seen it in suicide as well.
Sure. So you must have a fairly large staff, being one of the largest wellness centers. Talk to me about some of the struggles you've experienced with attracting employees during a time of staffing issues. What are you guys experiencing as far as being able to keep up with the community with having the right team in place?
So one of the phrases that we coined at Team is that humans are our greatest asset. So our human resource department is very, very important to us because our staff are. And when you have and you're hosting 400 employees to help the population that we serve, and we probably have about 15 to 16,000 patients on our books, and we are probably reaching 8,500 to 9,000 of them annually. It definitely takes a divine calling, this army of social workers, psychiatrists, nurses, medical professionals, dentists, dental assistants, clerical people, all the way down to security and even our maintenance and janitors that are helping keep the buildings up, and transportation and case managers. Everybody is doing it. I believe it takes a divine calling to work with this population because it's a difficult population to serve because sometimes they oppose themselves. Yep. So in their diagnosis, they act out. There's these negative behaviors. There's negative characteristics that have become a part of that subculture. And sometimes it's because they're living on the streets, it's a self-preservation mechanism. So their hygiene is poor. They just aren't appealing to you on the surface. And some people don't know how to work with such a population. So that's a barrier to hiring, because when you're in school, the social work schools are not necessarily teaching you that you're going to be working with people who are of this caliber. Sure. You know, a lot of times, unfortunately, the social work schools have taught us such a sterile environment. Oh, you're going to have somebody just lying on your couch telling you all their troubles. Well, no. If we were in a movie, maybe.
Yeah.
But that's not the reality.
Sure.
This person just ran for their life because they were trespassing and didn't realize it. It didn't realize they had somewhere else to go. And they ran into the building because they thought the person was still chasing them. However, when you look at the cameras, nobody's chased them, and you can follow them for 3 miles and nobody's ever been behind them. That's who you're dealing with. And when we try to recruit, we are competing with mainstream healthcare. So mainstream healthcare, mainstream hospitals probably have a higher price point to pay, more benefits to offer, and a little bit more luxury for the people to work. So sure. To get people to actually work with this population, a Medicaid recipient population, is a barrier, but when we find people, they've embraced it as their own calling, and we have a very strong network because of it.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, for someone to come work with your team, it's really all about the desire to serve.
Yes.
And it's not about financial compensations. I mean, of course, it's important to be able to provide for your family, but the type of work that you're doing is all about having a purpose, and that purpose is to serve.
Yes. Yes. And we all, not we all, most of us recognize that service is the best work of life.
Sure.
When I came into this and this side of healthcare, and I came to team, I've been fortunate. My mentor have been two of the most wonderful people I could have ever met in my life, Pamela Lamb and Tony Policella. Tony is the owner of team, and Pam was the president and chief operating officer of team since its inception.
Got it.
And everything that I know, I learned from them. And everything I know operationally, I learned from Pam. And one of the key attributes was that level of service. Anecdotally, when we ran the psychiatric hospital, I remember stepping off the elevator and there was this crowd. And I'm like, what's the crowd for? And I was looking for Pam, and I'm like, can't find her. So I made my way through the crowd, and the crowd ended up being employees. And there was a lady kneeling on the floor, and she had a scrub brush in her hand, and she was cleaning the baseboards of the corridor. And she was teaching the staff how to take pride in that level of detail when it came to the cleanliness of the hospital. And it was and I'm like, what are you doing? She said, well, I wanted to show them what I want and what I think we should be projecting as a company when we're trying to help people. And that just spoke volumes to me. And that was in 2006.
Wow.
And we've just kept that mantra up until this present day.
So the leadership is not afraid to roll up their sleeves and get dirty and be on that ground floor level with the rest of the team.
Correct. Correct. Yeah, it's not an executive-itis industry.
Sure. You said there's about 400 employees in the organization?
Yes. So we have 400 employees over 7 locations. And that includes a 24-hour call center, too, because we are also accredited by the American Society of Suicidology. So we are also trained in suicide prevention, which is definitely key for our industry.
Yeah, unfortunately, it goes hand in hand with the mental issues and even the substance abuse.
Yes.
So let me leave you with this question. How important is the culture to a medical organization, and how does leadership make a difference?
When I teach the classes that I teach at team, or when I'm leading orientation, I always start with this. The character of the kingdom emanates from the character of the king. So the leaders or queen, the leaders set the tone. We're going to determine where our values are. We're going to determine whether or not we're in this for the long haul. We're going to determine whether or not we can really impact the lives of the people we're charged with serving. If we don't have leaders that are committed from the top down, then the organization will be weaker as you get lower in the organization, and it won't survive. The executive staff is so important. I'm even advocating right now with Samsung on the federal side. They have a program where they are incentivizing licensed healthcare professionals to work in underserved areas. So if you work in an underserved area, the HRSA will pay your student loans off.
Wow.
And for the last 3 years, I've been in their ear and talking and saying, what about the executive? What about the people who don't necessarily have a license, but they've committed to this industry as opposed to, you know, working on Wall Street or wherever else, some other corporation. But we have just decided to be executives here.
Sure.
Because it is that same kind of a commitment.
Sure.
The leadership here has to be committed to this vulnerable population and their well-being and their quality of life.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think folks in the executive level in your industry serving the populations that you are serving deserve more recognition. You're doing the work that must be gratifying and rewarding. I would imagine that's what keeps your team moving and passionate about coming to work every day. But I think also more recognition is in call for folks like you, because you're doing God's work in some ways.
Yeah, I agree. And I certainly appreciate that, because as you're saying that, my mind is just racing with all the people in this industry that I admire who definitely are leaders and have stepped up and are really leading the charge to make the greatest difference.
That's wonderful. So let me throw one more at you, Michael. What do you see for the future for Team Wellness Center? What's next? What's in the 5-year plan?
So our goal is to make sure that we are always on the cutting edge of our industry with evidence-based practice. So yep. We want to make sure that we are growing in regards to our children's services. We want to intervene in the lives of kids as early as possible so that they know how to have help and get help with their mental health early on. And it's not a shock to them if something happens when they turn 17, 18, 19, but we've already been in their lives when they were 6, 7, and 8 on a preventative medicine trajectory so that if something happens, they're already ready and that stigma does not exist.
Sure.
And we also are looking to grow primary care and make sure we have married the physical health side of our lives with our mental health side of our lives. And we can truly look at it as just healthcare. So if you walk in the door about your high blood pressure, we'll still talk to you about your depression. And if you walk in the door about your anxiety, we're still going to talk to you about making sure you don't have diabetes or treating it as well.
Treating the body and the mind as a whole.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your time today. We've learned a lot about Team Wellness Center and the great work you guys are doing for the community. We hope you continue to grow and reach more patients and more families and better more lives. Continue doing what you're doing. And, thank you again for your time.
Hey, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.